It's time for Message in the Bottle on Downtown, brought to you by Bangor Wine and Cheese Company at 86 Hammond Street in downtown Bangor. Eric Mahan in the house with us. Good day, sir.
Good afternoon, evening, afternoon.
Yes.
After evening.
Happy anniversary to you and Christine.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. 13 years yesterday. She's still around. I don't know why. I have no idea. But it's always tough. So I wrote my newsletter about this. It's my one lingering regret from that day. I look back at all these pictures and my wife is beautiful.
Yes.
This is undeniable. But we have a very good friend, Ranuka Srinivasan, who is a veritable jack of all trades in terms of her skill set. And she did not only the dresses for all the bridesmaids, but also my wife's makeup. And so just, I mean, stunningly beautiful that day. And I am not an attractive man, like attractive men are attractive. I'm not like hideously ugly, but I'm, you know, like, so next to her, she's always, you know, the rose in the picture and I am the thorns. However, that day I was so wrapped up in everything else, I totally forgot to get a haircut. And so I'm looking at this, like all these pictures, and I'm like,
you could have used the beard that day.
It's true. I was not bearded. So that was, you know, it was just coming off of when I was a classical singer. I had had long hair, and in a nod to my darling mother-in-law Marge, she basically had a come to Jesus, like, you got to lose that hair, right? And I kind of knew that too, because you know, the first couple of forehead lines were starting to show, and you know, we're understanding where the future was leading us, and so I got my hair cut.
Two more combs on this side, and you're in a flock of seagulls.
That's right. That's right. It wasn't good. It wasn't good. But I was coming off of having this really wonderful hair, and it was magical. And so I have the college cut, and you know, that's the thing I've always done. But man, that I look at all these pictures and I'm just like, jeez, why didn't somebody pull me aside and say, hey, dude, I think we better just head down to the barber pole. You know?
Isn't that every guy though? You look back at those wedding pictures and you immediately say, how did I pull that off? What was she thinking?
That's fair. I actually think the same about my father with my mother. So my parents are both second marriages, and I love my father. And I think, you know, he's a good-looking guy, and other people have said that too. Obviously, it skips a generation. But yeah, so they got married briefly before I was born. So I just turned 40. So, I mean, it was really peak bad hair in the U.S. time. And he had the chops, and he had the hair kind of like me, except, in all fairness, Dad, I'm sorry, but he was already further along in that process where I am now, because he was about my age when he was getting married for the second time. And you could tell, like, all right, man, it's time to sort of, you know, bring it back home. And
kind of forget
about that. So it's pretty fun. So I look at that. No, you're right. You're right. I look at a lot of people's wedding pictures and I'm like, wow, she said yes. Well done, sir. Well done.
Well, look, here we go.
Oh, there it is. I'll see. But you look. You look fine.
Fine. I look okay. You look passable.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, there's nothing. You didn't look unprepared. You know, that's the thing.
Well,
folks watching at home on our TV channel, ESPN 12, you didn't see the picture, Bob. But
the men in wedding photos just may as well just be mannequins.
See, that's nice. Yeah, that's good.
We're only there as a placeholder.
Well, that's the other thing.
It's actually funny you say that, because
no one is looking at us.
That's right. One of the pictures that was taken was the photographers. We had a husband and wife team, and they did a groom with all the bridesmaids, and then the bride with all the groomsmen. And I've never felt more awkward. I was like, all these lovely women, and they're just sort of pretending to, like, you know, take their places around me,
as if
I was some sort of, you know, still life, but a bad one. So, I don't know, whatever. As I said, she still said yes. It was a wonderful day, and it was pretty good. I still get a lot of people commenting how was the greatest wedding they've ever been to, and that's, I mean, no one likes weddings. No one likes going to weddings. Let's be honest. I mean, at least guys, you know, I don't want to go to a wedding. And legit people have said that was awesome, and we tried to make it awesome, and that's the key, folks. If you're getting married, think less about yourself and think a little bit more about the guests. Because if they're not having a good time, you're probably not gonna have a good time. And we tried to make sure that our guests had a pretty killer time, and I think they did. However, I'm never doing that again. So I hope that Christine keeps me, because that's my gosh, I don't see how people can get married 3, 4, 5 times. I mean, for a variety of reasons, but anyway, cool. But it was, you know, in a gentle nod to today, before we talk about California wines and stuff, we were definitely talking about, should we get married on September 10th? You know, that's it was such a heavy, you know, as Kara was mentioning earlier, we've sort of, you know, lost the impact of it, the initial gut impact. But at the time, I mean, it was still super real. When we were planning the wedding, and we were like, my gosh, you know, is that a good time to do it? And we sort of, you know, we took the approach that a lot of people take. He's like, no, let's do it. Let's celebrate life. Let's do that sort of thing. So it was good. I was glad we did that, because that was a tough day. Today was a tough day all those years ago. And so, you know, I'm glad that some good, you know, was able to sort of spring around it.
Wow. And you made that your day.
Well, we try, it's the day before, but yeah, exactly. It's that, you know, you gotta have a reason on September 11th sometimes to wake up and still smile. And I think, you know, everybody woke up the next morning and had a headache and was smiling. And that was, you know, the key. So it was pretty cool. But anyway, yeah, not here to relive the past. That's actually a lie. We're going to talk about is absolutely
the
past.
Exactly what we're doing.
But we're going to talk about vino in California. So let's move on to that. So last week we sort of introduced, you know, that we're talking again about California, and we talked a little bit about what made California famous on the world stage now, and we talked about the famous 1976 Judgment of Paris tasting, and how that was, you know, that was really the beginning of what we know today as America's, and indeed one of the world's largest wine producing regions. And, you know, when we talk about other parts of the world, we talk about Italy produces this much, France produces this much. We don't talk about America produces this much. We talk about California produces this much. That's one state. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But how did it begin? Well, obviously, what's kind of cool about the California wine scene and all the New World wine scenes is that we really have a pretty good record, because it hasn't been going on for that long. And the people who started it, no surprise for frequent listeners of this segment, religious orders. Religious orders were the ones who started keeping records, and were the ones that were planting and bringing a lot of these grapes. Now, a lot of the grapes were being brought by a wide variety of immigrants, but of course the people with the skills to write down what was happening were obviously, you know, the more educated members of some of these cloistered orders and stuff like that. So before we get to California, though, I do like to mention that the first efforts in America in general were frustrated. They were all on the East Coast, you know, your Thomas Jeffersons and all of our founding fathers who liked their hooch. But the phylloxera louse, which we've talked about a lot, was present on the East Coast. And so they brought all these varietals, you know, your Merlots, your Cabs, blah, blah, blah. And they all died. And they really didn't know why, because we didn't have microscopes powerful enough to figure out what the heck was going on here. And it was only later that we figured out it was a bug, a small bug. So that didn't really work, and they kept importing and importing and importing. But when, you know, we went to the West and started settlements in California, the first established settlement was actually, it wasn't, you know, again, it's not that long ago, 1769, the first vineyard was established in modern-day California in Baja. It was the San Diego Mission, excuse me. Founded by Junipero Serra, who was the father friar there at the time. And it's incredible. That was the first established vineyard in America, 1769. That's it. That's really incredible to me. However, why it was successful is because phylloxera wasn't there at the time. It did come later, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But yeah, so vinifera took hold. And immigrants started bringing over our favorite grape, Zinfandel, which we're going to try briefly today. Mataro, which is called Mourvèdre or Monastrell over in Europe, and a couple of other varietals. And they really, these are thicker skinned varieties that like warmer weather and slow ripening. And so they did very, very well in California. And of course, California, I mean, really from top to bottom is extraordinarily good agricultural land, and so it spread quickly up and down and really established a foothold. However, in the late 1800s, our good friend the phylloxera louse made its way to California, so that was bad. And shortly thereafter, America said, you know what? Booze in general is bad. So we had prohibition. So the California winemaking industry really got knocked about the head for a good period of about 20 years. And then when they started to recover, another good 10 years of prohibition. And the savvier winemakers out there said, oh, no, we're making religious wine. We're like, you know, that's our thing. And so Franciscan Abbey, you know, anybody who, you know, knows wine, that's one of them that survived. You know, that's what they did. But basically, it really, really ruined them. And of course, then we had the world wars. That took a lot of able-bodied people out of, you know, who would otherwise have been, you know, picking grapes and doing all, you know, the farming, the real grunt work. They were all gone. They all got killed. Then we had the Dust Bowl. So there was a lot of things that sort of drove people to California, but then they didn't really succeed there. And it took really until the late 60s, early 70s, right before the Judgment of Paris, to have some of these mostly European emigres of that generation, not, you know, 6, 7 generations, but first generations coming and saying, okay, well, we're going to, you know, make our way in America after World War II. You know, we had a really good established relations. Remember that when we had good established relations with our European counterparts? Anyway, and so they settled, and Warren Wisniewski and these other guys, they were really instrumental in bringing California back, because the land was there. The grapes were there, although they were mostly in overgrown, you know, bad conditions. And people really, it wasn't a viable industry until basically poor people who had nothing better to lose, or rich people who had money to lose, but no one in the middle. They really came and took the industry by the jugular and dragged it into this last century and now into this century. It's incredible, ever expanding AVAs. That's American Viticultural Areas. Every year it seems like there's a new one, because there's so much good vineyard land out there, and there's so much other good land that can be, you know, dedicated to growing the crops, and then you can use some of the poorer land that the vines like. I just have a couple seconds left, so I did want to mention the wine I brought in today was the Pizzazz Zin by Carol Shelton. We actually had her Wild Things Zin last year. This is her entry level, named Pizzazz for the vineyard. She kind of riffs off all the vineyard names, but it's from the Piazza Ranch, so she said Pizzazz is the Zin. It's really wonderful, bursting with fruit. It's a really good wine day. So I invite you all to check that out. Carol Shelton, one of the first important female winemakers out of the California wine industry, along with Helen Turley, Mila Handley, really graduating from University of California, Davis, in the late 70s and really making their name in the 80s. Carol named winemaker of the year 5 times. So obviously she knows what she's doing and keeps making wonderful wines. Before running out of time, the 20th of this month, which I guess is next week. We have my friend Jason Sheridan from South Portland Wine Company. He's going to come up and taste us on some really excellent California wines. So I do invite you to come out to that. And of course, you know, stop in at any time. Other than that, we can sort of guide you through what we have. We also have a really excellent wine of the week, which is not California. And it is from actually the arch of the heel of Italy, from a little place called Basilicata. And I invite you to try that as well. That is made out of the grape Aglianico. So next week we'll talk about the other California, new old world, Rhone Rangers, all that good stuff. But anyway, cheers, happy anniversary, Angel, and we'll see you next time.
And your hair looks great.
Well, you know, that's because I came home, I realized.
Eric Meehan, Bangor Wine and Cheese Company. Message in the Bottle, Tuesdays on Downtown.